How about this? Is this working? Yeah. Should I turn it up a little bit? I don't know how. Thank you. Okay. So I want to tell a little story. And then what I wanted to say is this is a true story. True story. The story is takes place when I was 5 years old, 5 or 6, a long, long, long time ago. When I was 5 or 6, I had a scary dream. So I'm going to tell you about my scary dream. So I was outside playing hopscotch. You know hopscotch? All right, I was outside playing hopscotch. I was all by myself. And in those days, the sidewalks had these little concrete pavers. They were like this, and they were stacked side to side, perfect for hopscotch. And I noticed I was all alone. That was the first thing I noticed. And the second thing I noticed was it was. And I threw out my rock and I started to hop, and these pavers started to move a little bit, kind of like they were sitting on top of pudding or jello, something like that, you know, kind of. I wasn't very secure. And I'm hopping, and then I felt the hair on the back of my neck kind of stand up. And I was scared. And I knew behind me, where I couldn't see, was a big monster coming out of the earth. And I was so scared. But I couldn't see him, and I was too scared to even turn around and look at him. So I started to run on these pavers, but the pavers were getting smaller and smaller and further apart. And at some point, I realized I couldn't outrun the monster. And either I was going to sink into this molten jello, or I was going to be eaten by this monster. So what do you think I did? What would you do?
I would definitely stand.
Definitely stuck in the jello. That's an option. When?
Stare down the monster until it backs off.
That's what I did. But I didn't do it calmly. I did it because I was scared to death. So I turned around and I'm sitting on the paver and I'm kind of wobbling, so I'm not on solid ground. And because I was so scared, I took everything inside my 5-year-old self and I shouted at the monster, "What do you want?" I said. And the monster, like this, big teeth, horns. Well, at the moment, it wasn't funny. And the monster stopped. And you know what happened next? He looked me right in the eye without any expression particularly and melted into the ground. And I was terribly relieved, right? That's the end of the dream. Phew. So this dream had a big impact on me. You'd think, or I thought, boy, 5-year-old facing the demon, I'm a courageous person. That's what I thought. But really, what I learned is I'm a big scaredy cat. Big scaredy cat. But I found out through many years that you can be brave, but that doesn't mean you're not going to be scared. So sometimes we're scared, right? Have you been scared? Yeah. So Seth is scared, yeah. You look around. Is there anybody here who has not been scared? Not been scared. Everybody's been scared. Scary, sometimes it's scary, right? So can you see that sculpture behind me on the altar? Can you see? What do you see? Buddha. Actually, it's a bodhisattva, but a Buddha in training almost. And what's he doing? What's food? What's the bodhisattva doing? Yeah.
Sitting on like
a lion or a tiger. Or
some kind of big cat.
Big cat. Yeah. And what does Manjushri? So that bodhisattva is called Manjushri. I heard that you know something about Manjushri. Heard the name Manjushri? Well, Manjushri, what is Manjushri doing on the tiger? Yeah, he looks pretty calm, like, nah, nothing's bothering me. I'm calm. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, a Buddha of bravery. And what's the tiger doing? Is the tiger taking a nap? No, yeah. That kind of like my monster. Yeah. Might come out and bite somebody. Yeah. Well, you know what else I noticed about him is you got this bodhisattva sitting on the back and he's nice and calm, like nothing's going on. And the tiger, he's not tied down, is he? No, he's free to move around. So another thing I noticed about being scared is, let me check my notes. Sometimes when we feel scared and we feel like there's no way out, right? Sometimes you feel like I did. I couldn't run faster than that demon. There was no way out. And what I had to do was stop and turn around. So one of the other things I've learned in life is that facing our fears is way better than trying to run away, because the running doesn't go anywhere. But stopping and facing the fears, sometimes you find out that our fears are way worse than the real thing. Like, I thought that monster was going to eat me, but when I turned around and faced him, not such a big deal. He kind of just and melted back into the ground. Manjushri has the scary thing all down. He's the bodhisattva of facing scared stuff. But he's an unexcelled bodhisattva. Totally knows how to calm his mind. He calms his mind. He's like the tiger. The tiger and he are now like one. So what do we do when we are scared? What are some things you can do? What have you learned? Take a deep breath. Thank you, Annie Rose. Take a deep breath. And sometimes we can grab the hand of our parent or teacher, or sometimes just a friend, to help us hold our hands while we face our fear, because we all need that sometimes. So you don't have to do it alone. All right, I think that's it for scary things for children. Anything else? You know what you get to do now? You get to go back to Uji and
sing songs and other types of fun.
Which is not scary, and that can help you face your scariness. All right, dear ones. Thank you. Oops, I need to move on. Oh, okay. Here, let me help.
Yeah, but you don't lift it by the
Okay.
like that.
Okay. Oh, it's kind of got all movable parts. I forgot to do homage to the Buddha, so let me do it now. Because I definitely need it. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So that dream actually played a big part in my spiritual development. And I do want to just do a call out that says, sometimes when we're young, and there's lots of stories like this, we have very, very powerful experiences that stay with us. And some of you, actually, they say they believe that almost all of us have a significant spiritual experience by the time we're age 7. We don't always remember it, especially if it's not supported, if people don't talk about it. So it had a big impact on me in that when I started to sit, scary things happened, started to come up in my meditation practice. And there are many times we have to face scary things, even in the real, in our everyday world. Sometimes things look unpredictable, or violence is uncurbed, or sometimes it's just a deep-seated fear that kind of looms over us like that monster. In our meditation, we often meet these fears. And it's not like when you sit down, things are naturally going to be peaceful. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this. So when we first start to face ourselves, it can be pretty scary. When you sit and don't get up and move, you have a chance, you have an opportunity to see who you truly are. And sometimes that can be very uncomfortable. And sometimes it makes you want to run away. When we sit in meditation at Sesshin, there's nowhere to run. That's kind of part of the value of it. It's a good place, a good practice to stay still. In that moment when I'm running away from that monster, that point where I stand still and I'm so scared. But I go ahead and turn around is a very important moment. Everyday life also has many conditions that can keep us feeling this trapped feeling. I can't go on and I can't go back. I can't outrun this monster and I can't face it. What do? We feel kind of trapped. Our fears can feel like riding that tiger up on the altar. I think that's why it's there. How do you stop the fears from turning into something so big that it keeps us from having a full life? Keeps us trapped in a halfway life. When you can't go on living in your fear, or sometimes I've heard it say, you can't stand living in a belief system that doesn't feel like you, doesn't feel true, feels phony. That was more my experience. And you're willing to throw away this life I've been living and seek out something more authentic, that you might die. Sometimes it feels like you might die to change your life so drastically. That's when real practice starts. Kadigiri Roshi called it the terminal station. Perhaps you've heard that expression. What do you do when you reach the terminal station? when life no longer feels tenable. It's the end point. There's no more running away. What do you do? A lot of times you come here. Sit still, right? When you make up your mind to stop running from or chasing after something, you can rest in the world just as it is. Katagiri says, when you finally stop trying to escape, you allow yourself to see something new. So it's a place of blooming. It's a place of growth, a place of spiritual growth. It's not all that bad, though you never will go there willingly. I don't believe. I don't know. Maybe somebody can tell me, I did it willingly. I'm like, ooh. But you find yourself there. And I just want to say, part of the talk is, it's okay. Let yourself go there. When we don't escape from our fear, but face it, open ourselves up to it, open ourselves up to that part of us that feels like we might die, we get a chance to see something new. You see your true nature. The fundamental reality of our human nature. We see two things kind of simultaneously. One thing you see is you're not all that. You're not all that beautiful. You're not all that smart. You're not all that rich. You're not all that strong. You're not so wonderful as you maybe thought you were. So that's one thing you see. And the other thing you see is that you're part of and intimately connected with something so much more rich, so much more beautiful than you ever could imagine, that you are all that. So instead of who you believe you are or how we imagine the world to be, we simply touch what is most intimate, the truth of reality. So this is the beauty of our practice, that we are given the space to do this. So the truth of reality is wisdom. So we go back to Manjushri, sitting on the tiger. Manjushri is the bodhisattva wisdom, or sometimes called clear seeing, sometimes intellect, but that didn't resonate for me so much. So I asked the question, what does Manjushri see? He sees that all things are empty, just like my monster. Manjushri sits in silence up on top of his tiger and contemplates or investigates all things, all phenomena. And what does he see? He sees that everything is empty of real existence. Everything is like my monster. All existence is empty of solid nature. And here's my favorite. Even emptiness, even Manjushri sees, even that emptiness of emptiness is empty. So that takes a pretty strong bodhisattva practice. It's empty of real existence. So how does this support Manjushri riding a wild tiger? What do those have anything to do with each other? I've been studying the commentaries on Shantideva's wisdom chapter, and they note that when we see the emptiness of all phenomena, including the emptiness of emptiness, is empty, we are relieved of all suffering. So even our scariness is empty. And we see for ourselves the emptiness of phenomena when we get to that place and suffering is allowed to go drop away. Compassion floods our field of awareness. So often you see Buddha sitting in the center and wisdom, Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara, compassion on either side. They really are kind of the same thing. Once you get to wisdom, what you experience is compassion. And there's a great care for all beings, everything, even little bugs, even people who don't agree with you, people who you are confused by. We care about them. And it fills the practitioner. You are then participating in total reality. So you're swimming in the whole mix. So that's kind of how that works. And one of the teaching, oh, it's over there. One of the teaching tools is koans. So koans, for those of you who may not know what they are kind of nonsensical statements that doesn't allow us to use our intellect to solve them, or they aren't really meant to be solved. They're meant to teach, but not necessarily, there is no right answer. So what it does is it kind of locks us in this weird place, and then where there's no sure footing, there's no place to land, kind of like those pavers. And then at some point, it drops away. And then there you are, and you experience emptiness. In a way, koans force our hands. With nothing to land on and no secure ground to stand on and no right answer, what do you do? Right? We're so used to finding the answer. We're so used to fixing it. That's what we're supposed to do. So what understanding are you looking for? Can you let go of trying to get it right and enjoy the free space? Once we let that drop away, everything is allowed to be just as it is. We don't have to change anything. We just receive it. And then we can sit calmly on that tiger, right? That's why my Manjushri is on that tiger, is to demonstrate or to show that Manjushri is one with everything that's happening. It's not the tiger and Manjushri. They are one expression. So one of the koans I brought for us today is from the Gateless Gate, case 46. It's a real common one, actually. You maybe probably have heard it. And that the ancestor Osho offers us, how can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? So there you are, you're stuck. It's kind of the terminal station. You're on the very top of the pole. I heard this actually as, what do you do when you're on top of a 100-foot pole? How do you jump? Can you jump from the 100-foot pole? And when I first heard this koan, I wondered, would I be able to be brave enough to let go of the top of a 100-foot pole? That's like a flagpole. And I have to be honest, just thinking about it made me cling to that thought. No, I'm not ready. How do we face these scary places with great respect, with great sincerity, and with great earnestness? Because that's what it takes to let go. Sometimes we might need to hold a hand, but eventually you will have to do it and let go all by yourself. And when you do, your practice is open to wisdom. In reviewing this koan, another ancient sage added the phrase, "You who sit on top of the 100-foot pole," calls out, "the many Zen students who have found enlightenment are happy and are happy with it." I wanted to point this out because it's kind of like the magic city. You get to a place in your practice where you kind of got it figured out. You kind of got it handled. But that is not the point of our practice, Zen practice. Our practice offers us a place of rest, but it's not the liberation that our Zen teachers talk about. The comment goes on, "Although you have entered the way, you are not yet genuine." And this reminds me of Dogen's Fukanza Zengi. When we chant, a lot of you have chanted this, "Suppose you are confident in your understanding and rich in enlightenment, gaining the wisdom that knows in a glance, attaining the way and clarifying the mind, arousing an aspiration to reach for the heavens." Well, that seems like a pretty cool place. Let's stop there. No, then it goes on. "You are playing in the entranceway. It's just the beginning. But you are still short of the vital path of emancipation, total liberation." That's the practice. Total liberation. This is an important Zen wisdom. So it goes on to say, climbing the pole is your personal enlightenment. And that's not a small thing. And maybe in this lifetime, that's where we get. After all, we practice lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. But stepping off is for all beings. So we step off the pole for all beings. That might give you a little courage. It's worth it, right? It's such a small thing if it's just about you. It's such a grand thing if it's about all beings. Makes me teary just thinking about it. Your enlightenment benefits you, but that doesn't go far. It is the stepping off the pole with the total liberation to move about this world. It is returning to the marketplace with open arms and share your practice with all beings. So that's kind of that's an important Zen teaching. Then when we do, there's nowhere you can't go, it says in the teachings. When you step off that pole, you can go anywhere. You are free to experience the whole enchilada. And that is pretty amazing. So what might this look like? To experience the whole enchilada. Actually, the inspiration for talking about scary things was from a Layman Pong story. And it's a silly story, so I want to share it with you. So there's a story of Layman Pong, and it's his whole family as actually revered and considered masters. And he has a daughter. I didn't write the daughter's name down. Ling Zhao, who is also, and some people think is even more enlightened than Layman Pong or more skillful. And the story is they're making money by selling wicker baskets, and the dad is walking down with carrying all these wicker baskets. And he trips and falls on a rock, and all the baskets go flying, and he falls flat on his face. Quite a scene. And the daughter, seeing this, runs forward and throws herself down next to her dad on the ground. And the dad says, "What are you doing?" And the daughter says, "I'm helping. I'm helping." Now, don't you think that's a silly strategy? I thought that was pretty silly. How could the daughter be said to be helping the dad, right? How is that helpful? What does enlightenment look like? Any idea we have of it? That's not it. Going beyond the expected, the daughter throws her whole self down, a selfless action, ready to help liberate the intimacy already inherent in any situation. She doesn't consider what she should do. She just does this action. And how different that story would be if she had just held out her hand and said, "Here, let me help you up." That wouldn't have lasted 1,500 years. We wouldn't be hearing this story had she done that. So she, without thinking, throws herself down on the ground with her dad in compassion. "I'm with you, Dad. I'm here. I don't care about my image. I don't care about self-conscious." Now, people aren't talking about you spilling baskets everywhere. They're talking about me, the stupid daughter. Why did she do that? She doesn't care. She just does it. And the closing line of the whole thing, the father says, "Luckily, no one was watching you." So kind of like a little salt, like, "Luckily, no one was looking." But really, when you think about it, when we relate to each other without self-consciousness, it's so most intimate, and everybody's there with us. We're all together. And sometimes in our life, there's nothing to be done but to throw yourself down, right? Sometimes that's what's being asked for. Just throw yourself down. It's okay. Stop and face a monster that's larger than life. Throw yourself down. Fall into the abyss. Let go. Fall down. And the best part, because we're part of this wonderful, wonderful Sangha, is we get to do it together. So that's my topic. So now we're open to questions or comments or observations.
If you're in the center, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. Please say your name before you offer your questions or comments. And hold the microphone close to your mouth so people on Zoom can hear you. If you're on Zoom, you can either type your question or your name and Tony will unmute you or read the question out for you.
Thank you so much for your talk. This is Patrick. In the first story, you were forced to turn around and face the monster because the pavers got smaller and smaller till you couldn't go farther. What happens if the pavers don't get smaller and you can keep going forever?
And you can do that. Right, and
forever.
People do. People do that. They die running. You choose.
I guess then at what point do you throw yourself down? At what point does that cross your mind?
Well, when you want something different. When you want to face yourself.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Genko. In the early part of your talk, you talked about you're not all that beautiful, wonderful, special, I don't know what all. And I thought, okay, when are we going to hear the other side of that? You're also not all that terrible. You're not all that pathetic. You're not all that much of a failure. And because those are the two things that I believed about myself, both of those things, which was very confusing. So, you know, for me, what I had to do, a couple of things I had to do, but one of them was to recognize, actually, I'm somewhere in the middle because I'm just human. And that's kind of where we're at. The 100-foot pole has also been a big koan for me, but in terms of like doing this willingly, I realized that when I decided to ordain, there was a certain amount of willingness there, all even though I didn't know what I was up against, of course. But and I'm stubborn enough that even when I came up against it all, I just had to keep sitting still. And for me, that's been the way that I really faced the monster, was sitting still and beginning to realize, but I'm actually still here, I'm still alive. Huh, imagine that. So there's a lot of ways this can work, but I appreciate the way that you have presented it.
Yeah, the stopping is really kind of the stopping is really important.
It is.
And not running. But the other part too, Genko, that I hope to emphasize is you're not all that, and you are more than you can imagine.
Yes, yes.
And you have to be willing to accept that too.
Yes, indeed.
Because that can be very overwhelming when you see the whole universe for the very first time.
Yeah, I think Martin Luther King said something like that, where it's like, your fear is not that you're not good enough. Your fear is that you are more magnificent than you can imagine.
So true.
Yeah.
You hear that a lot about practice. You know, they sit in silence and they experience that emptiness. And one of the first things that happens is you pull back. You know, you just get a taste of it. And it's because it's big. It's vast.
Hi, this is Mess. What do you do? Like, fear for me sometimes is it's a reflex response. It's hard to even get to that, like, take a deep breath. I wonder if you have any practice for, like, that tiny space.
As Ginkgo said, you sit still. And that somewhere something happens deep inside. But yeah, and you know, when I told the kids, you hold somebody's hands. Hold somebody's hands. I'm scared. It's okay.
Thank
it's
you.
A scary world, especially now.
Hi, this is Dio. I don't have a question. I just wanted to express gratitude for this mode of Dharma delivery, like the emphasis on story. And I noticed how while you were telling the story to the kids and then the kids left and you continue telling stories to us, that the tone didn't change all that much. I don't know. I just, the lessons kind of, I can feel them land deeper.
Oh.
I appreciate you.
Thanks, Dio. I appreciate that. You know, kids suffer just like adults. You think that they don't have any of the worries we have, but they suffer just like we do. And they are scared just like we are.
This is Colleen. Thank you for your talk. Genko talking about the koan of not special versus I really am really special. My problems are mine uniquely. My fears are mine uniquely. Nobody else has these fears. And you say it when you say take somebody's hand, but I think what really came to me was this is the Sangha jewel. This is, you know, you have to sit alone with that. And then you also have to say, I'm not the only one who has this fear. And other people have these kinds of fears too, and be willing to be open to that.
Yeah, and send them loving kindness. Send loving kindness to all beings who are fearful. Because there's a lot. We don't know who they are, but you can bet that they're all over the world. Because we're all human.
Hi, this is Julia. I had a moment during Sesshin that I would be unsurprised other people also have had, where I was like, oh, like I could go anywhere from here, essentially. Like, absolutely nothing, something, whatever. I also had the feeling of I don't want to do whatever comes next by myself.
Can you say a little more?
Yeah. Like, I suppose my question is, what does, like, I don't know, we're in silence so much. It's like, what is the doing it together?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You know, for me, when I sit alone, I'm actually not alone. I'm sitting with all beings. I'm sitting with the whole Sangha. And I feel that energy coming into me, coming, you know, sitting with it. So I guess the question is, what does it mean to be alone? You know, how isn't that a fabrication of the mind, being alone?
Thank you.
The emptiness of emptiness, empty. The thought.
Hi, this is Charlie. The fear that I've had after coming back from a Theravada retreat was how clear they're able to describe everything, and then coming out of it, as soon as I felt confused and lost again, then there's this whole fear around losing that security of, oh, this is practice, this is reality. And I didn't realize how scared I was of then feeling that after the retreat until I was listening to a podcast that a friend of mine was on. And at the end of the whole podcast, the guy asked him, well, what would someone do if they were just feeling quite numb, overwhelmed, or stuck? And my friend just said, oh, just welcome the stuckness. Just feel lost. And I hadn't, that was like exactly what I needed to hear. And being able to then just welcome feeling lost, like, took the fear away for me, hearing someone else say it and then giving it a shot and seeing what it felt like. Mm-hmm. And that feeling lost wasn't as scary as I imagined.
Yeah, it's really our imagination that makes those places really more than they really scary is our imagination. But when we stop and actually be with it, it tends to lose its power over us. It's the fear that keeps us from taking that power back. So, yeah. And welcoming it. And when you say that, what I'm hearing is you're accepting the world just as it is. You're welcoming the world without your qualifications or without your judgments or without your ideas of what would make it more perfect.
Yeah.
Well, you know how it feels when somebody doesn't accept us just for who we are, right? Kids really know that, what it feels like to not be accepted just as you are.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I was curious about your story, how you were saying, like, how everyone at like 5 or 7 have like a story where they're just like, yes, that's what made me who I am. And I'm like, is that true? Do I have that? And it wasn't a dream. It was like what was happening at the time when I was like 4, my parents were getting divorced. Mm-hmm. And of course you get like this philosophy in your head where it's like, oh, they're like having conflict all the time. If I avoid conflict for the rest of my life, everyone will stay in my life. And I thought I had found the secret to life. And I think my karma is realizing that's not actually realistic. And you learn, you lose a lot of self-knowledge if people aren't allowed to like speak their mind, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make you who you are, but it does follow you through your life. And if you revisit it, I guess is what I'm saying. So like there's the Buddhist story where he's under the cherry tree and he realizes the interdependence of all life. And Dogen has an experience like that when he's at his mother's funeral and he's watching the incense burn. So it's a pretty common thing to have it. But avoiding conflicts, then you learned that that wasn't the answer. So now where are you with that?
I guess I'm learning to speak a little bit more openly and just like value that and value that in other people. Like if they just like speak to me openly, I'm like, oh, I now have a perspective that many people would have just like pushed under the rug, you know?
Cool. So you allow people to have their expression, even though it's different than yours.
Yeah, that's what I hope to do.
All right. Is there any other questions? I think we're getting wrapping down here.
Thank you. This is Grant. I think I'm still struggling with the word emptiness in my practice. And I guess where personality and identity kind of fall into that. And I know the kind of point is to let that go because it's a free flowing thing. You're not the same person you are today as you were yesterday. But there's that inherent worth of a human feels quite full. And how do you separate that to find the emptiness to embrace the greater?
Mm-hmm. That's practice.
Yeah.
You know, you have to get still. When you touch stillness, you touch that emptiness. And I think that's the point of practice. Sitting silently. Allowing that tape that runs in our mind. It's pretty boring, actually. Once you start to listen to it, you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. You know, it's monotonous, it's small-minded, it's not really very interesting, actually. That's what I found. Maybe your mind's more interesting. So it was easy to give it up. But when you really listen and listen to what's going on in the brain and just be kind to it and let it go, let it drop away.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right.